This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And beginning on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the headline across the top of the page, Handsome Pay for Leaders of Public Charities. And this article runs horizontally across the top of the page. To the left, there's a graph with the headline, Paid to Lead, and it shows the top 10, and there's a little caption that goes along with it. With LC Industries' William Hudson leading the way, following are the top paid chief executives of public charities in the Triangle, along with the annual revenue of their organizations. It gives the top 10, and we'll discuss those in the article. The article is written by Jason DeBrun and Cameron Snipes with the Dateline of Durham. While the term public charity conjures up images of frugality, that's not always the case when it comes to compensation of executives. In fact, some top-level administrators at Triangle Public Charities bring home paychecks their private sector counterparts would envy. Take William Hudson. For running a Durham public charity called LC Industries, Hudson was paid $826,531 in 2010. He would have to see his compensation cut by more than half before reaching the next highest compensated charity CEO, Dennis McLean with Goodwill Community Foundation, who received $394,020 that year. An examination of tax records of more than 50 of the Triangle's largest charitable organizations, meaning those that qualify as 501c3 tax-exempt organizations, also reveals that Kerry Watson, CEO of Associated Health Services, received $490,724 in 2010. But Watson also is the CEO of Durham Regional Hospital. Since the organizations are related, his compensation is listed on tax forms for both entities. By comparison, Richard Broadhead received $879,024 for his position as president of Duke University, a $2 billion organization. And as for public companies, Frank B. Holding Jr. is paid $867,000 for his job as chairman and CEO of Raleigh-based First Citizens Bank, but that's a company well known for its conservative ways with the dollar. More typical is the $3.8 million paid to Salix Pharmaceuticals CEO Carolyn Logan in 2010. She heads a $500 million drug company that some say could grow to $4 billion in the next decade. LC Industries provides employment for people who are blind, most often though through manufacturing or distribution of more than 800 products. Efforts to reach board members of the organization were not successful. Finding the sweet spot of a fair compensation for public charities executives while being responsible with donated or tax money is difficult, says Robert Getzenberg, a board member and member of the Compensation Committee for the National Cancer Coalition. Many of the top executives could earn more money in the private sector, so boards want to pay them enough to keep their talent, but need to walk the line of fiscal responsibility. How do we come up with something that we think is fair? Getzenberg asks, rhetorically. In 2010, the NCC, a $180 million organization, paid CEO Rob Landry $309,437. NCC is the largest charity in the Triangle by revenue, but Landry received the seventh highest total compensation in 2010. When comparing the salaries of the various charitable organizations to their size, it seems budget, revenue, or assets are not good indicators of a CEO's salary. Take the Goodwill Community Foundation, which helps people with disabilities find employment, as an example. At $36 million, it ranked 16th in terms of revenue, but CEO McLean received the second highest total compensation. How charities pay their executives also varies. Joe Pizzi, board chairman of Easter Seals UCP of North Carolina and Virginia Incorporated, says his board gives various bonuses in addition to base salaries. NCC, on the other hand, pays employees only a base salary with no bonuses, Getzenberg says. Pizzi says keeping valued employees well compensated is important for retaining them. Sometimes we need to spend a little more money in compensation, he says, and not just to the top executives, but to all employees. Compared nationally, Triangle Charities pay their executives well. GuideStar, an organization that tracks not-for-profit organizations throughout the United States, releases annual compensation reports. It does not break out charitable organizations specifically, but notes that nonprofits such as research institutes, RTI International, for example, pay their executives more than religious organizations or those focused on housing, shelter, or youth development. For example, RTI, a $750 million research organization, paid top executive Victoria Haynes $751,143 in 2010. The median for the top 53 Triangle charities, including organizations such as the V Foundation, the YMCA of the Greater Triangle, and United Way of the Greater Triangle, came to $161,000. That's higher than the median compensation for science and technology research institutes, the highest median compensation subgroup tracked by GuideStar, which had a median compensation of $156,493 in 2009. On the average, the economy has taken its toll on nonprofit salaries, something GuideStar CEO Bob Odenhoff says is not surprising, even if it is disappointing. Given that our employees are our sector's greatest assets, it's more important than ever to establish and benchmark compensation ranges that will attract and retain skillful employees, he says. And as we move down the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the rest of the page is a precursor to a group of articles inside the Triangle Business Journal. And this large picture is of the large end of a magnifying glass, and within that there are circles of pictures of different people that are profiled inside, but the caption, or the headline on the front page is, Super Science, How Area Researchers Are Studying Everything Around Us to Make Human Lives Better. And then there's a caption to this, Facing questions ranging from how snakes clone to which is the best tick repellent, Triangle scientists are doing the work of progress every day. And we'll get a sampling of some of those articles that start inside the Triangle Business Journal. And there are 10 of these profiles, and we'll read some of them. The first one is a profile of Melinda Beck, and it's written by Cameron Snipes with the Dateline of Chapel Hill. Tens of millions of people in the U.S. get a vaccination to protect against the flu virus every year. But according to Melinda Beck and her 9-person research team at UNC in Chapel Hill, those vaccinations may not be as effective in people of an unhealthy weight. Numerous studies have shown that obesity can cause or be a significant contributing factor to a number of health problems, including diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, and sleep apnea. But Beck and her team at UNC Chapel Hill have come to discover that obesity has one more strike against it. It can negatively impact the effects of flu vaccines. Beck's research has consisted of 2-year-long studies on 500 test subjects each year. The study, which originated with mice subjects, got its human study participants at the UNC Family Practice Center, where Beck and her researchers set up shop and asked patients who were coming in for flu shots if they would like to participate in the study. We set out to see how obesity affects immunoresponse, Beck says. Of the subject pool, 1/3 was at a healthy weight, 1/3 was overweight, and the final 1/3 was obese. For clarity's sake, obese is defined as having a body mass index of more than 30 kilograms per cubic meter. Overweight people have a BMI of between 25 and 30. In year one of the study, participants were given the 2009 to 2010 seasonal flu shot in the arm. Those participants then returned 28 to 35 days later for a post-vaccination blood draw. After the one-month blood analysis, it was determined that all subjects responded favorably to the vaccine. All made nice antibody responses in a month, Beck says. It's interesting to note that Beck's study, which was published in the International Journal of Obesity, showed that obese people actually mounted a vigorous initial antibody response to the vaccine, a reaction Beck cannot explain. But a vaccine is protective only if the antibody titer or concentration is maintained throughout the period when the flu virus is circulating in the population. That length of time is usually about 5 months, Beck says. It was the 12-month blood analysis that really told the tale and gave credence to Beck's hypothesis. Those results, collected in the second year of the study, were from a second set of about 500 participants, about a third of whom were from the year one study. After the post-12-month vaccination blood draw, results showed that increased BMI was associated with a larger drop in antibody titers. In other words, obese individuals had a steeper decline in vaccine antibody over time compared with healthy weight individuals. T-cell responses were also not as effective in obese people, according to the study. The findings also suggest overweight and obese people are more likely to become sicker and have more complications, says Heather Pak, a doctoral student in Beck's lab. Beck says the study results are particularly telling since about 66% of people in the U.S. are overweight or obese. Other questions remain, but they will have to wait until more money is available to fund the research. Beck's research was funded by grants from the National Institutes of Health to the tune of $500,000 per year. We're waiting for more money, she says. And the next profile is of Warren Booth. This one's written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Raleigh. It may sound like a Michael Crichton novel or a movie starring Samuel Jackson, but the litters of baby snakes with only one parent are all science and no fiction. Warren Booth, a postdoctoral researcher in North Carolina State University's Department of Entomology, has discovered that boas sometimes reproduce through a particular sort of parthenogenesis, a process similar to cloning that involves no father. In two litters of boa constrictors, Booth discovered that embryos formed with the nuclei of egg cells fused with other cellular bodies within those same cells, much as egg nuclei fuse with sperm nuclei in normal vertebrates, animals with spinal columns. The vast majority of vertebrate species reproduce only sexually. While parthenogenesis has been documented in a handful of shark and reptile species, Booth is the first scientist to document the particular method of parthenogenesis among boas. Booth says it's conceivable that his parthenogenesis research, which is ongoing, could one day feed into stem cell research by helping to create embryos that are more genetically similar to the mother than naturally produced embryos. More immediately, the research may help breeders to develop economically valuable lines of pets and livestock more quickly than can be done now, he says. Booth primarily studies ongoing evolution in insect populations, arriving at NCSU from Northern Ireland in 2006 to study cockroaches. But he has long kept snakes as a hobby and is a scientific advisor to the United States Association of Reptile Keepers. A snake breeder in Tennessee tracked him down in 2009 with a boa with rare and valuable coloration, gave birth to 12 similar offspring. The breeder asked him to determine which of four males had sired the litter. Booth analyzed the DNA of the four males and the 12 young snakes and determined that none was the father. Moreover, the snakes were all female and had sex chromosomes that resembled neither males nor females. Like humans, in which an XY chromosome pair determines a male and an XX chromosome determines a female, a boa with a ZW pair develops into a female, and an offspring with a ZZ pair develops into a male. The father usually contributes a Z chromosome, and each baby becomes a male or a female, depending on whether the mother contributes a Z or a W. The offspring from the Tennessee breeder were all WW, meaning that there was no father. The second W chromosome had come from a polar body, a cellular structure that, like eggs and sperm, includes half of an organism's DNA. Booth's next step with the boas is to determine whether any of the WW offspring are themselves able to reproduce sexually when they come of age, hopefully in late 2013. If so, parthenogenesis could be important for the species' survival, and doubly so because the first generation of parthenogenic young are all females, whose numbers most directly limit a species' ability to propagate itself. Moreover, the generation resulting from sexual reproduction will also be entirely female, and all of those are likely to produce litters of both males and females. It's such a widely kept species, and it's remarkable that we know so little about it Booth says. And our next profile, written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Chapel Hill, is of Carl Castillo. A distance of about 3,000 miles separates Carl D. Castillo's Chapel Hill office from the Belize coral reefs that preoccupy his thoughts. Castillo is a 41-year-old UNC Chapel Hill postdoctoral researcher who is making a name for himself with scientific papers contending that the reef, the world's second largest, is under serious threat from global warming. Man-made CO2 dissolving in seawater raises both the acidity and the temperature of the water. Of the two, Castillo believes he's identified the culprit that's stressing out the 620-mile-long Mesoamerican barrier reef fronting his native Belize and its Central American neighbors, Guatemala and Honduras. I really think it's temperature, he says. His initial findings were presented in a paper published in February by PLOS One, which publishes peer-reviewed scientific articles. A second paper now in the works will present 30 years of seawater temperature data to support the point. Growing up in Belize with a stepfather who owned a boat, Castillo says he fished and swam near the coral shelf. I knew it was beautiful, he recalls, but I didn't know it was in trouble. That discovery came when Castillo and some UNC associates dove down into the clear blue Caribbean to take core samples from a dozen large boulder corals. The growth patterns, as traceable as tree rings, showed that the ocean side of the reef, the fore-reef, is growing more slowly than parts of the reef closer to shore. Decades ago, the growth pattern was the other way around. Parts of the reef closer to shore, Castillo surmises, exposed over time to both human pollutants and fresh water, have become more resistant to various irritants than the seaward coral. When healthy, the reef is a garden under the waves made up of 65 species of stony coral, creatures that lay down hard skeletons, supporting 500 species of fish, 350 types of mollusk, turtles, conchs, and manatees. Discovering what now ails the reef, Castillo believes might result in a better set of recommendations for its management. And the stakes are high, since it's the reef that supports both the regional fishing and the tourism industries. Emily Cooper of the Washington, D.C.-based World Resources Institute, through a 2009 study of the Belize economy, determined that the value of reef and mangrove fishing and tourism in the country, population 333,200, is on the order of nearly $560 million. As a reference point, she adds, Belize's GDP totaled $1.3 billion in 2007. Holding a doctorate in marine sciences from the University of South Carolina, Castillo was drawn to UNC in 2008 to work with John Bruno, a marine ecologist in Carolina's biology department who has become his mentor. Castillo says he has been offered positions at the University of Belize, but he's reluctant to give up the resources available to him at UNC. For the time being, Castillo remains content with summer trips to his native land in search of more core samples. Though out of sight for most of the year, the distant reef and its puzzles are never far from his mind. It is what I am thinking about a lot of the time, he says. And our next profile is of Stephen Meshnick. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Chapel Hill. A study conducted by researchers at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill found that clothing treated with Insect Shield brand repellent fends off nearly all ticks. The study, which was not funded in any way by Greensboro-based Insect Shield LLC, found the product had a success rate 93% better than spray repellent or other tick bite prevention methods. The pilot study was the brainchild of epidemiology graduate student Megan Vaughn, who tracked tick bites on 16 outdoor workers from the North Carolina Division of Water Quality. Results showed that for every 100 hours spent outdoors, those wearing clothing treated in Insect Shield repellent had 99% fewer tick attachments during work hours and 93% fewer tick attachments overall than a control group. Thanks to that initial study, researchers from UNC and NC State University were awarded a $1.2 million four-year grant from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. For the two-year expanded study, researchers have enrolled 140 workers from the North Carolina Division of Forestry, Parks and Recreation, and from the Division of Wildlife Resources, half of whom will wear clothing treated with insect shield. The study is double-blind, meaning neither the researchers nor the workers know if they are wearing clothing with the repellent. Though Dr. Steve Meshnick, UNC epidemiology professor and lead author of the study, says some of the workers are developing their own theories based on who has more tick attachments. I have to be very impartial, Meshnick says, but a lot of people seem to think they know what group they are in. We've had lots of anecdotal evidence. After two seasons, which will conclude in September of 2012, researchers will unblind the study and report results. Jason Griffin, Insect Shield Vice President, says when the study results come in, he expects them to be the same as the first time. It's a little nerve-wracking, but we are very confident about the performance of the product, he says. We believe that we will see equally strong results. Insect Shield markets a line of repellent treated clothing through various retailers, including Orvis, L.L. Bean, and REI. For the UNC study, workers sent their clothing to the company, which treated the apparel and returned it. And our next profile is of Robin Moore. And his profile was written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. Plenty of published studies support evidence that children aren't getting enough physical exercise and that trips to the neighborhood park could be one of the best ways to boost physical activity. But a new study out of NC State University shows that overprotective parents and caregivers could be the ones getting in the way of children's playtime exercise. It was one of several surprise findings from a study that observed the activities of more than 2,700 children who visited one of 20 parks in Durham in the late spring and summer months of 2007. NC State researchers, with funding from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Active Living Research Program, used trained student observers to document ways people use city parks and which park features are more likely to encourage vigorous active play. The purpose of the study was to provide guidance for better park design. What they found was that children, especially kids aged 6 to 12, will engage in more rigorous activities when other children are around, but those same children may slow or stop their play when a parent or caregiver approaches. The parent or teacher has an authority relationship over the child who, as a result, feels the need to constantly seek approval to play. Every time the parent or caregiver approaches, the child feels like he may be playing beyond the tightly prescribed limits and therefore stops, says Robin Moore, a professor of landscape and architecture at NC State and principal investigator for the study. In some cases, Moore says, a child may stop play to simply share comments about what's going on with the caregiver. Here, the danger is that the caregiver takes over so that the activity ceases to be the child's free play, so-called colonization of free play, he says. Such interaction can be a creative means of exploring and building stronger social relations between adults and children, but at the far end of the continuum, of course, is genuine, free, spontaneous play where the child, usually with other children, has complete control over the space and time of play. Moore says there is much concern that opportunities for free play and its positive support of healthy childhood are disappearing from children's daily routines. Jim Salas, director of Active Living Research, says the data showing the effects of what's been called helicopter parenting on children's activity levels went above and beyond the original intent of the study. That was a surprise, Salas says, but it has helped us find out ways people use parks and how parks can be designed to promote a more active experience. For example, Moore says providing more comfortable, shady seating areas for caregivers could encourage them to stay longer. They are not checking the time after 20 minutes because they are bored or hot, he says. Parks should also be well-maintained with up-to-date equipment and plenty of diverse plantings of shade trees and flowering shrubs that offer year-round interest. Family recreation areas should be enclosed with a fence and only one entrance so parents know that the area is protected. The report also concluded that characteristics of the neighborhood around a park are not as important as the environmental features of the park in engaging physical activity. Jason DeBrun wrote the next profile, and this is of two people, Saranda Robinson and David Jolly. And this article has a dateline of Durham. Pretty soon, barbershops in and around Durham can think of themselves as health clubs too. Well, maybe not quite, but researchers from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and North Carolina Central University are targeting barbershops, particularly those that cater to black men, as an avenue to encourage more exercise. By increasing exercise, 46% of black men are inactive. Researchers hope to cut down on major diseases such as cancer and diabetes, which disproportionately affect black men. Researchers chose barbershops because they are, quote, a good way to reach black men, unquote, says David Jolly, chairman of NCCU's Department of Public Health Education. Barbershops provide a way for researchers to get in the community and connect with a group of people in their environment. Laura Lindman, working from UNC Chapel Hill, has done similar work in beauty salons, but those target women, and she wanted to reach out to men as well. Naturally, barbershops seemed like a good idea, and the researchers will work this year to encourage exercise and see how much it improves health. Called Fit Shop for Fitness in the Barbershop, the project will isolate 14 barbershops, 7 active and 7 control, with 40 to 50 participants each. For the active group, researchers will measure weight, body mass index, and other health indicators of participating men and give out pedometers or other measuring devices to various participants. Researchers will then kick off Fit Shop, and barbershops will host competitions to promote physical activity. After 6 months, researchers will measure everything again and track how the men performed. For the control group, researchers will measure health indicators, but not enroll them in Fit Shop. While this might sound unfair, researchers will provide a different kind of help. These men will receive coaching on their finances through various workshops. This way, the project can reach into a community in two ways and gather health data at the same time. That is really community-based, says Jolly. Historically, black men have distrusted researchers, most notably for what happened in what is now known as the Tuskegee Syphilis Study. So this group wants to reach black men through a trusted avenue, that being the barber. Barbers are trusted sources of information, says Saranda Robinson, an NCCU professor of epidemiology and partner in the project. Also, the researchers will not just swoop in, take some data, and leave, what Jolly referred to as helicopter research. Instead, they will involve themselves, making regular updates in the hope of improving the health of participating men, not just collecting research to then sit on the shelf. Ideally, the participants will realize benefits from being more active and sustain that lifestyle. Fit Shop receives funding from the National Cancer Institute, which made an $11.9 million grant to NCCU and the UNC Leinberger Cancer Center for 5 projects. And now we'll continue with some other articles in the Triangle Business Journal. If there's time left at the end, we'll read some more profiles. But now we turn to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, Scotty's going to be busy opening for Brad Paisley. And there's a picture under that headline of Scotty McCreary. And the caption reads, Scotty McCreary at his welcome home feat in 2011. Garner Scotty McCreary is going to be a busy young man when he joins the headliner Brad Paisley for a 21-stop tour on January 12 in Grand Rapids, Michigan. The tour wraps up on March 4 at SeaWorld in Orlando. In between, the American Idol champ and booster of his Garner High School Trojans will see a lot of arenas and even make a stop on January 28 for a Saturday show at the Mandalay Bay Resort in Las Vegas. Once the tour ends, McCreary's show schedule is clear, save for a booking on October 15 in Dorton Arena as part of the 2012 NC State Fair. UNC Hospitals has been named a top hospital by the LeapFrog Group, which analyzes voluntary survey information to determine its list. The state-supported Chapel Hill Hospital was one of 65 nationwide and the only hospital in North Carolina to receive the honor. Some hospitals, including WakeMed in Raleigh, did not participate in the voluntary survey and were therefore not eligible for the rankings. Nearly 1,200 hospitals filled out the survey nationwide. It was unclear whether Duke Medical Center participated. The LeapFrog group, based in Washington, D.C., considered factors such as how patients fare, resources used to care for patients, and management practices that promote safety and quality. Durham Technical Community College's Parent Academy has received a $25,000 grant that pushed Durham Tech's total awards received over the past 2 years past the $2 million mark. That's the most the college has ever received in any two-year period. Durham Tech President Bill Ingram says grants are becoming ever more important due to budget cuts. He cited Duke Energy Corporation as an important local supporter. We've been fortunate to receive local grants, he says. Grants have supported professional development for faculty and staff, allowing the college to reach out to the community in new and different ways, he says. Michael Walsh, a retired professor who lives in Whispering Pines, loves Panera Bread's Thai-chopped chicken salad. So you'll be hearing him talking about it in a radio spot for the chain that was recently taped in Raleigh. Walsh and his wife, Gail Parker, a teacher, spent about 90 minutes taping the 30-second spot at Soundtrack Studio. The spot will air on 8 local stations. St. Louis-based Panera Bread has a dozen locations in the Triangle. Walsh and Parker typically dine at a store in Aberdeen in Moore County. J.R. Manley took a job preaching at First Baptist Church in Chapel Hill 65 years ago, and he's still in the pulpit. This month, Manley will step down from his position, and church members are celebrating his longevity as well as his service to the church and community as an advocate for civil rights, education, and senior citizens. His years of ministry here at First Baptist is reflective of a life of service to everyone because he has so freely given all his time and his talents and his energy, Elizabeth Davis, church secretary and a church member for 35 years, told the Daily Tar Heel. Manley was 19 when he filled in for a departed preacher at First Baptist. It took him a few weeks to catch on to his gig, but he obviously did. If you start seeing people around Raleigh holding up their smartphones to store and restaurant windows, there's an explanation for that. A new company called Love It, Promote It, or LIPI, has distributed nearly 500 QR code stickers to businesses in Glenwood South, North Hills, and other areas that contain information on specials along with website and social media profiles. Jason Humphrey, LIPI founder and owner, says he intends to monetize the service by charging businesses a monthly fee. Carolina Hurricanes defenseman Derek Jocelyn got some face time in a recent issue of ESPN the magazine. He was photographed walking down a flight of stairs as he and his teammates searched for a place to practice in New York because Madison Square Garden was being used before a game against the Rangers. It cost the team $750 for 90 minutes of ice time at Sky Rink, a deal when considered the peak price there is $1,500 an hour. The extra practice didn't do much good. The Canes lost that game 5-1. As for Jocelyn, he's back in Charlotte now. Brady Train Incorporated, an HVAC service and supply company, recently opened a parts center on Bennett Memorial Road, its third parts center and 10th location overall. The company transferred 2 employees and hired 2 new people for the location. The store's manager is Mike Aulis Hill, formerly of the Raleigh location. Company director Ken Qualls says the Durham location is aimed at saving time for contractors who now have to drive to Brady stores in Raleigh and Greensboro. The Greensboro-based company employs 330 people. Chapel Hill's Posen has renewed its shelf offering registration with the Securities and Exchange Commission, but don't expect the drug developer to sell new shares anytime soon. The company has never gone back to the public market after its initial public offering in 2000, but has kept 8 million shares on the shelf, so to speak, in case it needs to. The SEC requires these shares to be registered, and Posen's registration will expire in January. So this is simply a renewal, says Bill Hodges, Posen's chief financial officer. This is actually the second renewal. The first shelf was filed December 12, 2005, with the first renewal on December 4, 2008. Posen believes it is prudent to have an active shelf registration, Hodges wrote in an email, but added that, "We do not have any plans to sell any shares under the shelf registration." The 8 million shares would raise some $31 million for Posen, which had $46 million in cash and short-term investments as of September 30. It's early 2012, and Duke University already is rounding up its class of 2016. Through early admissions each fall, the university fills about 40%. This year, it ended up being 38% of its next incoming freshman class. The Duke Chronicle reports that this year's early commit class will be 648 students selected out of a total of 2,641 applications. That translates to an acceptance rate of 24% for the early decision program, the lowest ever. "We've denied more students this year than we have in the past," Dean of Undergraduate Admissions Christopher Gutentag says. "I feel like we have a certain responsibility to students if we're certain that we wouldn't admit them in April." While many students, here's hoping most of them, cite the Duke faculty for choosing Duke and committing early, some had other reasons, such as Krzyzewskiville, the tent city inhabited by students wanting to get early dibs on hoops action at Cameron Indoor Stadium. The remainder of the class of 2016, some 1,057 students, will be chosen through the regular admissions process this spring and summer. Holly Springs office and school furniture manufacturer, OFM, has given its annual product catalog an injection of technology. The catalog, which is distributed to the company's dealers, this year contains QR, or quick response, codes that lead buyers to additional information about a particular product. The codes can be read by apps available for most smartphones. Some of the codes lead users to product videos, while others lead to specification pages. Using this kind of interactive technology is unheard of in the furniture manufacturing industry, so we felt this was an opportunity to offer our dealers something they can't get elsewhere, says Blake Zalkberg, Chief Operating Officer of OFM. Whether they are on the road or in the office, now our dealers and potential customers will have the ability to learn more about OFM's products at the touch of a button. And contributing to Biz were staffers Jason DeBrun and Amanda Jones Hoyle. And now we return to some of our full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to has the headline, "Many North Carolina Med School Grads End Up Practicing Elsewhere." This article is written by Jason DeBrun with a dateline of Durham. And above the picture, there's an aerial photograph of a large building. The caption reads, "Rendering of Campbell University's proposed medical school." It's an aerial view of that rendering. When it comes to retaining medical school graduates, North Carolina ranks in the bottom third in the nation. In North Carolina, 41.3% of active physicians completed their graduate medical education here. That ranks 36th in the nation, a spot North Carolina has held for at least 5 years. For North Carolina's two private universities with medical schools, Duke University and Wake Forest, the numbers are even lower. From the graduate class of 2005, 23% of Duke graduates and 32% of Wake Forest graduates are still practicing in North Carolina, according to data compiled by the North Carolina Area Health Education Centers Program and the Cecil G. Shepps Center for Health Services Research, part of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Still, graduates leaving for other states does not necessarily translate to an exodus from North Carolina in general. In fact, the number of physicians practicing in the state has increased at a faster rate than has the general population. In 2006, North Carolina had 229.1 doctors for every 100,000 residents, according to data from the Association of American Medical Colleges. That number increased to 236.5 per 100,000 residents in 2010. Tim Carey, director of the Shepps Center, points out that North Carolina actually imports more doctors than it exports. He is more concerned about a shortage of physicians, particularly those in primary or family care in rural areas. John Weinerth, Associate Dean of Graduate Medical Education at the Duke University School of Medicine, agrees that broad conclusions shouldn't be drawn from this data. The bottom line of all this is people make their choices on multiple factors, he says, listing social, family, and economic as just a few. In some cases, students are placed in residency programs outside the state, then decide to stay there instead of returning to North Carolina. Various data sets show physicians are more likely to stay where they complete residency programs, even if it is not in the same state where they attended medical school. Still, North Carolina is continually trying to plug a gap in the number of family practice doctors. Recognizing the issue, Campbell University hopes to open its $60 million School of Osteopathic Medicine in 2013 and plans to enroll 600 students by the fourth year. In the 2010 to 2011 school year, North Carolina medical colleges enrolled 2,029 students. This is something that we've been talking about for months now, says Dr. John Kaufman, Dean and Chief Academic Officer of Campbell's proposed School of Osteopathic Medicine. Graduates would earn a Doctor of Osteopathy instead of a medical doctorate, or MD. DOs have the same latitude as MDs, but are more likely to go into primary care, says Kaufman. The shortage of primary care physicians in the U.S. has been well documented, and with the exception of the Brody School of Medicine at Eastern Carolina University, North Carolina's medical schools graduate mostly specialists. A case in point, of Duke's 78 graduates in 2005, 18 were still in training or practice in primary care in 2010, and six of those were in North Carolina. One of the missions at Campbell will be to graduate students to fill the shortage of primary care physicians in North Carolina. We see ourselves as making a positive impact on the state in terms of keeping physicians in primary care and in North Carolina, Kaufman says. In our next article in the Triangle Business Journal, is written by Chris Bagley with a Dateline of Cary. The headline, ADA lawsuit spree by Florida residents makes mark in North Carolina. Two disabled Florida residents are suing dozens of restaurants, department stores, and shopping centers across eastern North Carolina, alleging they were endangered by violations of the Americans with Disabilities Act. The lawsuits filed by attorney Jacqueline London of Jupiter, Florida, have targeted several hundred businesses in Florida, North Carolina, and Virginia, and other states since 2009. The latest round has hit at least 30 businesses from Winston-Salem to Wilmington since September, including department stores at Cary Town Center and a Big Lots store in Cary. Plaintiff Denise Payne suffers from cerebral palsy, according to her court filings. Cerebral palsy is a condition that develops during pregnancy or infancy and persists with lesions on the brain and spinal cord, disrupting a person's control of his or her motions. Payne says she visited the Big Lots store in 2010 and 2011 while visiting a friend who lives in Cary. Owen Hardy, who is suing independently of Payne, was paralyzed below the waist when a bullet fired by a drunk relative lodged in his spine. The lawsuits most often allege violations of measurable standards, such as slopes of handicapped access parking spaces and toilets placed at improper distances from walls and railings. At least three are aimed at Big Lots, an Ohio-based chain. Others target Hooters and McDonald's franchises and shopping centers in Raleigh, Greensboro, and Winston-Salem. Payne didn't return a phone call to the National Alliance for Accessibility, a Fort Lauderdale-based nonprofit corporation she helps to run. The nonprofit is a co-plaintiff in many of her lawsuits. Hardy couldn't be reached. London declines to discuss the lawsuits in detail, but says Payne was visiting North Carolina to build up her association. As an enforcement mechanism, Congress has included in the act private enforcement with fee awards and depends heavily on private enforcement, such as this complaint, she wrote in Payne's lawsuit. Enforced since January 1992, the ADA allows disabled individuals themselves to sue for alleged violations. The Justice Department can also sue, but does so less frequently. Payne and Hardy are suing under Title III of the Act, which requires public places to make accommodations for customers with disabilities. A separate section of the Act covers workplace accommodations. Title III doesn't allow plaintiffs to collect damages in verdicts, though settlements can run into tens of thousands of dollars. They typically call for coverage of legal fees ranging from $5,000 to $15,000, says Greg McGuire of Ogletree Deacons in Raleigh, who has defended clients in ADA lawsuits and emphasized that he wasn't referring specifically to Hardy and Payne. Attorneys in the lawsuits filed by London say the settlements seem in line with the time and effort London and the plaintiffs put in, but declined to discuss amounts, citing confidentiality agreements. One attorney, whose clients have been sued by Payne and Hardy, Randy Avram of Kilpatrick Townsend in Raleigh, says he advises clients to determine whether they're fully in compliance with ADA and act quickly to address any shortcomings, preferably before a lawsuit is filed. Some of these she's been right about, and some of the things she's not necessarily been right about, Avram says. The businesses typically spend $200 to $5,000 to correct violations, though some have spent up to $60,000, he says. Avram says the largest wave of ADA lawsuits came in the 5 years after the act went into effect. Smaller waves have crested now and again. One attorney says most clients would have made the adjustments voluntarily if they had been notified instead of sued. It's more difficult to assure compensation for a plaintiff's attorney in such out-of-court dealings, the attorney says. McGuire says he advises clients to act quickly in a lawsuit and detail any steps they have taken to comply with ADA. They believe they're doing some good, and they may be, McGuire says of London and her clients. And our next article has the headline, Mighty Multifamily. Apartments rule the real estate roost among investors. And accompanying this article is a picture of the outside of a building, looking up at it. The caption reads, Oberlin Court Apartments fetched $72.25 million in sale to Prudential. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. Investors' appetites for top-tier apartment properties in the Greater Triangle region translated to more than $963 million in investment property sales in 2011. But it was the sale of a shopping center and two office properties that topped the list for best in show. Inland American Real Estate Trust's $95 million purchase of the White Oak Crossing Shopping Center in Garner in August outranked all other commercial real estate deals in 2011 to take the top honors for highest price paid for a commercial property in the Triangle. The $88.8 million sale of 11 office buildings at Keystone Technology Park in Durham came in at a close second. And the $75.8 million sale of the Quintiles Headquarters office building on Emperor Boulevard in Durham was third largest deal of the year. But after that, the honors belonged to Mighty Multifamily. More than 30 apartment communities in Wake, Durham, and Orange counties were traded in 2011 among 50 different investor groups from across the country, according to a Triangle Business Journal survey of commercial deals valued at more than $10 million. The volume of deals at height-of-the-market dollar figures was enough to push the Triangle investor market back to near peak levels for apartments, says Jeff Glenn, an investment broker with CBRE in Raleigh, who specializes in multifamily housing sales. With the single-family housing market in the doldrums, more people are renting rather than buying, giving more value to apartment complexes as investment choices than in the past. Glenn notes that investors participated in only $250 million worth of apartment transactions in 2009. The total for apartment deals in 2010 was $528 million. He credits the return of institutional investors to the real estate market for much of the 82% bump in the transaction volume in 2011. Entities of Prudential Insurance Company, for example, paid $53 million in October for the Woodland Terrace Senior Housing Complex in Cary, and also paid $72 million for the Oberlin Court Apartment Complex in Raleigh in a November deal. Northwestern Mutual Life Insurance Company helped prop up several apartment properties in the Triangle after Charlotte-based Crossland splintered its real estate divisions, including its multifamily development arm. Former Crossland executive David Raven has since formed his own multifamily company and is managing many of the Triangle area apartment assets owned by Northwestern Mutual, including Chapel Watch and Cosgrave Hill in Chapel Hill and the Arboretum in Cary. While apartment sales are expected to remain a hot commodity in 2012, other sectors of the commercial real estate market will likely face many of the same challenges as in 2011. The commercial mortgage-backed securities, or CMBS, market continues to remain a challenge for investors who may have a balloon loan payment coming due or whose building income is underperforming. With apartments, everyone is climbing all over each other to get to them, but there's a niche of properties in the $5 million to $30 million range where the glut of the market is, and there are so few transactions, says Greg Trainer with Fairfield Asset Advisors of Denver, Colorado. Fairfield assisted in the December 29 sale of the 112,000-square-foot Trinity Place office building on Edwards Mill Road to the Brookdale Group of Atlanta. Robert Bach, chief economist for Grubb & Ellis Company, is predicting continued sluggish recovery in 2012, and much of the recovery can be attributed to limited new supply of all types of commercial properties. The lack of new deliveries funneled demand to existing properties, giving the market time to heal, Bach stated in a recent report. And now we're going to return, still in the Triangle Business Journal, to some of the articles listed under Super Science, how area researchers are studying everything around us to make human lives better. And our next profile is of Kobe Shaw. And his profile was written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Raleigh. In scientific circles, the term superbug doesn't refer to the tick. In fact, it has nothing to do with the blue fictional character created as a spoof on superhero comics. Instead, it refers to antibiotic-resistant bacteria, or bacteria that continue to live even after treatment with antibiotics. Historically, those in the medical field think of hospitals as the main incubators for antibiotic-resistant bacteria, but Kobe Shaw, a distinguished professor of entomology at North Carolina State University, says, "We need to be careful of other places as well. Specifically, he means hog farms. Commercial hog farmers use antibiotics not only to fight disease, but also to help pigs gain weight faster. Shaw, who has worked with researchers from Kansas State University, says common pests like flies and cockroaches that live on farms can pick up antibiotic-resistant bacteria and potentially spread these bacteria, superbugs if you will, to humans. The big concern is not that humans will acquire drug-resistant bacteria from their properly cooked bacon or sausage, but rather that the bacteria will be transferred to humans from the common pests that live with pigs and then move in with us," Shaw says. "It's also possible that these farm flies and farm roaches carry other microbes of great importance to human health. Researchers have found that bugs make their way into human residences, carry many of the same drug-resistant bacteria that are present in hog feces, suggesting that these common pests acquire the bacteria from contact with swine manure. These drug-resistant bacteria are rarely found in cockroaches and flies collected in urban areas." Shaw and his collaborating researchers collected samples of hog manure before it hit the ground, which, as you can imagine, is not easy to do, and compared it with samples taken from cockroaches and houseflies. They found the same bacteria that had genes that provide resistance to antibiotics, Shaw says. Some of these bacteria are resistant not only to single common infection-killing antibiotics, such as tetracycline and streptomycin, but also in combinations of antibiotics, making them multi-drug resistant. The research was funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and NC State University's Blanton J. Whitmire Endowment. The findings were published in the journal BMC Microbiology. Although the research suggests superbugs can make their way from hogs to humans through insects, Shaw makes clear this research shows only the potential for that happening. "There's absolutely no evidence for this happening right now," he says, "but we are suggesting that there is the potential for the insects to move these antibiotic-resistant microbes to the human community." Jennifer Komen, Director of Producer and Public Health for the National Pork Board, emphasizes the potential aspect of the research, pointing out that there is no evidence of any ill effects on humans. "Obviously, public health is one of our top priorities," she says. "It's a top priority for everyone out there." Antibacterial resistance in human pathogens has been called a major health problem for the past 25 years worldwide by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, the World Health Organization, and the World Organization for Animal Health, among others. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read some of the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here's some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. State workers qualify for new health care service. Some 1,500 state workers covered by the state health plan are eligible to use the new Carolina Advanced Health, a joint venture between Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina and UNC Healthcare that's designed to treat the most chronically ill patients. BCBSNC will notify by mail the 1,500 plan members who qualify. BCBSNC administers the state health plan, which covers 664,000 people and pays out nearly $2.5 billion in annual claims payments. Carolina Advanced Health opened in Chapel Hill in early December. At the grand opening, BCBSNC Chief Executive Brad Wilson said it would help lower overall medical costs because it partners the care provider with the payer under the same roof. North Carolina's per capita debt compares to other states. North Carolina, one of only 8 states in the U.S. still carrying a AAA bond rating, has the second lowest per capita debt among the elite group. The lowest is Iowa, which had debt per capita of $73 in 2011. North Carolina's per capita figure is $765. As for the other 6 states in the group of 8, Missouri, per capita debt of $780, Virginia, $895, Utah, $957, Georgia, $1,120, Maryland, $1,608, and Delaware, $2,489. Care America CEO guilty of fraud. The co-owner of several assisted living facilities pleaded guilty to conspiracy to defraud the federal government and consented to a $4.8 million judgment, prosecutors said late Tuesday. Care America CEO and co-owner Ronald E. Burr filed IRS forms claiming to have paid more than $4.5 million in employment taxes that were due between 2003 and 2006, when little or none of it had been paid. U.S. Attorney General for the Eastern District of North Carolina, Thomas Walker, said in a news release. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. Our phone number, 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.